Every object and being in the universe is a jar overflowing with wisdom and beauty, a drop of the Tigris that cannot be contained by any skin. Every jarful spills and makes the earth more shining, as though covered in satin. Rumi. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. Thank you all for joining me this week. I really appreciate it, and I hope you will enjoy this episode. And if you're a newcomer, welcome to you again. Please avail yourself of our older episodes. We have quite a backlog. And this is an interesting one for you to dive in on. But this week, we will be beginning our focus on, I guess, the last of the Mesopotamian material cultures arising this season, or maybe next to last, but we'll get into that. Essentially, though, we're going to be covering the Ubaid culture, or the Ubaid culture, also known as the Ubaid period, or Ubaid period. And the pronunciation on that is not 100%. I've heard it pronounced both ways, but most people that I've heard actually talk about it use the term Ubaid. Now, this culture likely grew up in southern Mesopotamia, probably somewhere around the southern Euphrates, or just to the north of where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers meet today. Which does lead me to some listener feedback that I got that I want to go over. Now, I've known that the courses of the Tigris and Euphrates have shifted several times during written historical periods, sometimes slightly, other times drastically. And that's not that surprising. Rivers change over time, and we've talked about it a bit in earlier episodes, you know, at different, episodes. But I had a listener send me a link to a very detailed page on archatlas.org titled Environmental Change, The Evolution of Mesopotamia by Andrew Sherritt. And that was published in 2004. And it showed some different routes or theorized routes the rivers have taken over time. And it includes some great maps, topological maps. Essentially, though, what it shows is the Tigris and Euphrates, during the time frame of this season, enter the region more or less at the same place that they do today. But they meet much further northwest than today, actually near where the modern city of Baghdad is. And the combined rivers then traveled for a period and then split into a fan of rivers, streams, marshes, etc., as they emptied out into the Persian Gulf, which was also around 2.5 meters higher than it is today. Similar flow to today, except the combined flow is shorter and the Gulf is lower. And this flow was also fed by rivers, streams, and the like flowing down from the Zagros Mountains, like the Tigris is today. So instead of those coming down from the mountains, just entering into the Tigris, they were entering into the combined river. Now, another bit of feedback leads me into the simple irrigation we talked about last week. It was designed to keep agricultural land dry and limit the flood waters in these areas until it was needed or the crops had been harvested. Then they would just open up the fields to flooding. And I had someone ask what these first irrigation systems were and how they were made. And I plan on doing an episode about these. I think it will probably be between this section and when we move into the Indian subcontinent, though I may hold back until later this season. I need to look at some more stuff about East Asia, so I'm not 100% sure yet. Though I do want to emphasize that these were very simple systems, and they probably failed fairly regularly. They probably failed as much as they succeeded, which is part of the reason why that they continued to develop these irrigation systems to the more complex forms we will see later. Back to the rivers, the Ubaid, their sites, dating those, their discovery, so on. Now, the name Ubaid comes from, you guessed it, Tel al-Ubaid, the first site where evidence of material culture was found. The name for this hill probably means Hill of the Slaves or Hill of the Servants. It is also possible it could mean White Hill. The two words can sound very similar, especially depending on the dialect. And I say that they sound similar in Arabic. So if you're a non-native speaker or not very practiced in Arabic, you would probably need other context clues to know the difference. They are written differently, though. And while I think the Arabic for this Tel al-Ubaid looks closer to the script for slave than for the script for white, I though cannot read Arabic, not very well, at least. I know like one or two words. So I'm not really familiar enough with Arabic calligraphy to say definitively it is White Hill or Hill of the Slave. So I'm giving you both options for that. You're welcome to look into it on your own time. Or if you speak Arabic, how about let me know what the exact translation would that be? I know I have a couple of Arabic speakers come through in my chat on YouTube sometimes, though none from Iraq, sadly. At least none that I know of. Now, Tel Ubaid was first discovered and excavated in 1919 by British Egyptologist and Assyriologist Henry Hall. Also, a quick note of the term Assyriologist. Assyriologist in Assyriology is a kind of an old-fashioned term. It was kind of a parallel to Egyptology that was coined in the 1860s. And their earliest study and research was focused on Assyria and cuneiform writing, the same way early Egyptology was focused on the study of Egypt and hieroglyphs. Well, within around 30 years, some started to realize that that term was a little too narrow. Essentially, they figured out that the Assyrians were not the only people to use cuneiform, and they probably hadn't been the ones to develop it. So today you will see it used, but it's been replaced by things like cuneiform studies or Near Eastern studies, things like that. I guess unless your specialty is Assyria, in which case you would still definitively be an Assyriologist. Though, as we will discover when talking about Assyria, it's almost impossible not to talk about their neighbors, because they were so involved in wars with those neighbors. Now, Hall was a very interesting guy. It looks like he started out focusing more on Egypt, and then his interest kind of shifted. He served in the British intelligence services during World War I, and specifically he was stationed in Mesopotamia, because, again, he was familiar with the region, certainly more than most people were. And after he left the service and the war ended in around 1918, he traveled in Mesopotamia. And while there, he found Ubaid and was even able to excavate it for a brief period of time. Now, a couple of years later, he returns to Ubaid along with Sir Leonard Woolley in the early 1920s. Now, Woolley is an extremely important individual when it comes to archaeology, and we're going to talk about him much more in detail later. But he is considered to be the first modern archaeologist. He keeps meticulous records. He makes a note of where and how everything was found. He does systemic excavations. He searches one area completely and then proceeds to move out from there. So modern archaeology is built almost entirely on the type of work he was doing. Now, of course, we have far more advanced techniques now, but the very basis of, you know, the systemic and highly detailed record keeping as we're digging things up was kind of pioneered by Woolley. I don't know if he was the first to do this type of thing, but he's definitely the one that kind of popularized it and spread it to other students. who eventually spread it on to their students, so on and so forth. But because of his record-keeping and how renowned he was, Woolley was essentially placed in charge of a very large survey over, over the entire kind of southern Mesopotamia region in the early 20s. Hall and others accompanied him, though Woolley was in charge. Also, Woolley's wife, Catherine, who was an archaeologist in her own right, was part of these expeditions, of which Ubaid was one of many. But probably the most famous one in this kind of time frame was the study of the ancient city of Ur, which we will cover in a lot of detail later. Now, all of this goes without saying, but a lot more work has been done since then, and many more sites with Ubaid material culture have been excavated. And this has given us a decent idea of how the culture developed, evolved, spread, and evolved again, spread again, so on and so forth. Though I should go ahead and caution that some of the terms I'm using are not universally accepted, and there are disagreements about some aspects of what we will be talking about. Though I think most of what I am including is accepted by the majority. And another factor that I should go ahead and lay out at the start is chronology. The dates for all these periods we're going to be going over are very much estimates. Due to the way rivers flooded and kind of the way the clay is underneath the soil, finding archaeological evidence of any kind prior to around 7000 BC is very hard to do in southern Mesopotamia. So dates prior to 6000 BC are very iffy. That said, this makes the stratigraphy of the region very reliable. The same clay that kind of makes it hard to find stuff. It's hard to get past this clay. Like, digging it up is almost impossible in some areas. But this kind of, it makes things very clear. Okay, this site is the oldest. And then this next period preceded that. And so the simplified way of saying it, it just means that while we can't place people or artifacts firmly into a timeline, we can at least say that this existed prior to that, or this happened after that, however you want to phrase it. So that has given specialists the ability to divide the Ubaid period into smaller segments much more easily than, say, like the Halaf culture, where there are some examples where we think this happened at this site first, but we're not 100%. Or we think this site was Halaf first, but it may, or we think the site may have been Hassuna first, but it could have been something else prior. It's just one of those things that we kind of have to guess at. Now, these phases of Ubaid history are divided into, I guess there's six phases. They're divided into Ubaid 0, Ubaid 1, Ubaid 2, Ubaid 3, Ubaid 4, and Ubaid 5. Now, there are alternative names for all of these. Some are identified with a specific site, and some are kind of crossed over geographically speaking. Certain places did not reach Ubaid 3, and certain sites did not reach Ubaid 5, and so on and so forth. Also, again, one site may enter Ubaid 3 100 years prior to it reaching Ubaid 4, and where other sites were primarily Ubaid 4. So it's all back and forth based on geography and just, as things disseminated, like in terms of cultural artifacts. Ubaid 0 happens either between 6500 and 5900, or, again, depending on the chronology used, 6800 to 6200. These are just two different windows. Now, Ubaid 0 is sometimes referred to as Owayli And this is referring to Tell El Owali, which is one of the oldest sites that we have discovered with Ubaid material culture. And this translates to something along the lines of distressed or poor hill. And it is just about 6 or 7 miles from the Euphrates' current east bank. Now, this was not a particularly large settlement at the period that we're discussing. I think most of the Ubaid artifacts actually come from a later period. So this was probably just a small village at the start. And eventually it becomes more important. In fact, this is occupied well until the Ur III period, which is something we'll discuss later. But so a couple of thousand years that it's occupied for. So all the early Ubaid 0, Ubaid 1 sites are all kind of clustered in the same area around what then would have been fairly coastal or not too far from the coast. So that you're dealing with a lot of marshlands, wetlands, and things like that. A lot of the earlier houses are very simple, made of reed huts and things like that, sticks. Not too in-depth in terms of construction materials. The pottery is very simplistic, like we've discussed with these other groups. It starts off very utilitarian, very simple, very rough, though that does quickly change, as we will see. Ubaid 1, which takes place between 5,900 to 5,200, or 6,200 to 5,500, again, depending on the chronology you're using. This is known as the Eridu style, and this is because the original type site for this period was found at Eridu, which is going to become one of the first major cities in the world, at least what has typically been considered a city. As we've talked about several times, that definition's kind of nebulous in certain places, and there is a debate about whether there were earlier cities than that, and we've talked about that at length. But Eridu is one of the big ones when it comes to written history, at the very least. Now, where did the Ubaid people come from is something that we're not 100% sure on, but most people suspect that they came from the north of the Fertile Crescent, or towards that direction, and then they moved into the lowlands probably around 8,500, 8,000 BC, give or take, and they were probably very early agriculturalists. They were looking for places to raise crops, and then, they were kind of drawn to the plains of southern Mesopotamia. Now, that is not to say that they were primarily agriculturalists. They definitely had animals that they were raising and rearing as well. And they may have only shifted to, primarily agriculture a little bit before the Ubaid period proper starts. They may have been related to the Samara culture that we talked about last week. In the grand scheme of things, they're not that far from each other. And like the Samara culture, these people are very early adopters of irrigation. We've talked about that a little bit, but part of this region and doing this does mean that there are periods where certain stretches of the rivers do silt up. They'll basically the floods bringing down all this soil and nutrients, but it's also bringing up kind of salty land and earth, and it will dry out periods of the portions of the rivers, and it'll make some kind of no longer functional for agriculture. That's an issue all throughout history in the region, and that's maybe part of the reason that the Ubaid culture does eventually spread so far and wide. But all that being said, they are extremely successful at growing crops, and they do, even with all the hardships that this type of lifestyle has, they are able to generate enough food to have a surplus, quite a large surplus. And this allows them to create more villages and towns. And at their height, some of these towns could eventually have as many as, I've seen the number of estimates, but the larger end of them would be around 5,000 people, which, again, depending on your definition, that's not a town, that's a city. Most of these are, though, concentrated in the south. I don't think there are any Ubaidian sites north, or in northern Mesopotamia, essentially past Samarra. I don't think there's any city that size or town that size that far north. Now, in terms of pottery, as I mentioned earlier, very simplistic very early on, but even in some of the Ubaid Zero sites, there is evidence that they're beginning to experiment some. Where they have these much smoother pottery pieces that have been fired extremely hot, and they paint them with kind of these dark black lines, geometric shapes essentially. I'm not aware of them having any animal motifs like the Halaf or the Hassuna cultures. I think they're virtually almost all geometric shapes. But they do also create human-esque figures. In some cases, even, they have very exaggerated facial features that has led some people to believe that they might be serpents-esque people or like snake people. That has led to a lot of conspiracy theories connecting them with lizard people. Are, you know, having worshipped some type of lizard-esque deity or snake-esque deity. I think they do look fairly serpentine, but that could also just be them, you know, they may have, like, molded them more human, but then as they're baking or cooking, maybe they got kind of deformed a little bit. But that's just one of those things that I find funny about, like, ancient history and people, you know, being conspiracy theorists. Another evolution that begins to take place fairly early in Ubaid 1 is the reed houses begin to be replaced by those T-shaped mud brick buildings, or mud buildings in some cases. And like the Samarra, they're T-shaped. They have multiple interior rooms. They do have in some cases, courtyards, though that is not at all of the sites. Typically, early on especially, basically until the 80s, they were considered to be kind of an egalitarian society. However, that's recently been challenged. Early on, it seems like some sites had more of the more elaborate, more well-decorated pottery. And it's thought that maybe that is a sign of status and wealth, as opposed to just having a bunch of the more utilitarian, simplistic designs. However, towards the Ubaid 2 and 3 periods, which are also known as the Haji Muhammad style for Ubaid 2 and the Tel al-Ubaid style, which the Ubaid 2 is around 5,200 to 5,100, or 5,500 to 5,200, again, depending on your dates. And Ubaid 3 takes place between 5,100 to 4,900, or 5,200 to 4,600, again, depending on which chronology you follow. Around this time, you begin to see more differences in architecture at these sites. You will see a lot of small, kind of well-built, kind of planned out, centralized, some call it public architecture. It may have been a home for elites tied to a clan chieftain or a tribal chief or a village chief and their extended family. And then on the exterior of these smaller settlements, which generally take up about a hectare or so of land. You see a lot of more simplistic, more spread out houses on kind of the exterior of the sites. So wealth may have been something a little bit less ostentatious early on, but then that kind of expanded. So the idea that they're egalitarian, there's not a lot of division of labor, that is something that has recently been challenged quite heavily. Now, as they are producing these more elaborate public architectural structures, their pottery gets much more simplistic. It's still well made, much smoother than a lot of early Neolithic stuff, but also the amount of pottery that's being produced skyrockets. Now, this is also potentially a sign of more solidified divisions of labor. Perhaps the agriculture is doing well enough and producing enough surplus food that people are able to specialize. And due to the amount of pottery and the amount of food that they're able to produce in these villages and towns, the Ubaid culture is able to spread fairly quickly, or at least their pottery is. And it is during the Ur II phase, the Haji Muhammad style, that you begin to see some Ubaid pottery begin to get into northern Mesopotamia. And that's where you start to see it coming into contact with Halaf sites. And by the time you get to the Ubaid III period, you get to see that the Halaf culture is beginning to, or sites associated with the Halaf culture, begin to transition to tools and lifestyles closer to what you would see in southern Mesopotamia, the Ubaid style. Now, also, another thing that probably helped the Halaf, or excuse me, that helped the Ubaid culture produce pottery, pottery wheels. We talked about pottery wheels being present in what will be the land of Cana, Israel, Judah, Lebanon, those places. Pottery wheels aren't present in northern Mesopotamia, at least at this prior period. But it is present in the Ubaid culture. So they probably, again, developed it independently. And this is probably another reason they're able to produce so much pottery, especially compared to their northern neighbors. So if pottery was a sign of wealth and status, well, you know, if you're producing more of that, then you are, by definition, the wealthiest people. So that's probably part of the reason that their material culture is spreading so quickly. Now, this brings up, like, well, are they actually Ubaidian? Or are they just using Ubaidian pottery because there's more of it? They're just able to produce so much more. And that is something, you know, that is very, very, I think, correct to question. Were these sites that are transitioning out of the Samarra and Halaf cultures, are they out and out adopting just completely Ubaid style? Are they being tied into these extended alliance networks among village chiefs in the Ubaid, like, heartland? Sadly, we don't know. But that is a very popular theory. And the Ubaid culture spreads very far and wide. There is evidence of Ubaid-style houses eventually getting to Syria, and essentially replacing almost all of the Halaf. Now, there is evidence also of Ubaid pottery, as I mentioned, in Arabia, along the coasts. It's also present in kind of southern Iran, Persia, those regions as well. And those places don't necessarily have the rest of the Ubaid material culture, just their pottery. But that does show that they are trading at quite a range. And they're probably trading for things like lapis, carnelian, things that, you know, made up the Hassuna culture specifically. We know that the Hassuna and the Samara had those trade links, so why wouldn't the new Ubaidian culture take advantage of that? Also, around this period, oak trees, which existed in small numbers in kind of central Mesopotamia, essentially disappear. Hardwoods would have been very important for a lot of different things, so they were probably over-harvested and killed out to kind of feed this growing almost industry in the south. Another kind of aspect of Ubaid culture is they believe they have found very simple single-room dwellings that had kind of altars set up in them that probably housed statues of a god or goddess or goddesses or gods. And that, indeed, that kind of like very simple single-room structure is something you'll see essentially until like the first temples build up. So a home for gods, temples, the precursors to temples at least, are being built for the first time, at least as far as we can tell, in the Ubaid culture. Though, again, there was that one site, I believe it was in the Samara culture, where they found a building just filled with like female figures. So this may have been something that was common between the Samara and the Ubaid. And it's possible that the Ubaid and the Samara were at least somewhat related ethnically. If they shared an ethnic identity, there is a lot of debate about that. But obviously that's probably something we shall sadly never know. Also, another one of the downsides to typically having a large amount of food and resources, if there ever was a drought or if your irrigation system failed, you are at a disadvantage when it comes to providing food. So this may have led to an increased number of raids or low-level warfare between villages, even villages that typically might be peaceful in normal times or might even be related to you. So there is evidence for increased amounts of warfare during hard times, or, you know, to secure, at the very least, if not food itself, then the land capable of producing food. And again, this is something that's kind of the hallmark of this area very early on in written history. So there's no reason to doubt that it's happening at this earlier stage of prehistory. Another thing that we've found at the Ubaid sites, and I believe these are all from the late Ubaid period, which is late Ubaid on, which is around 4,900 to 4,300 or 5,200 to 4,600, depending again on the chronology you're choosing. This is known as the late Ubaid or Ubaid IV. In northern Mesopotamia, it's just part of the northern Ubaid period, which that technically, in northern Mesopotamia, there isn't as much of a division between the Ubaid styles. It's all considered northern Ubaidian. So even though the Ubaid sites are existing in the north, they're not evolving at kind of the same rate that the southern Ubaid are. They're kind of just rolling with changes that are coming up from the south, at least for a brief period of time. Later, they'll develop again independently. But they don't have the stamp seals that some of the other cultures do. At least they didn't develop them themselves. What they did was something a little bit different. We found kind of very rough clay tablets that have pictures assumed of a certain type of product, mostly almost always food. And these were kind of, the picture was drawn in and little dots were placed beside them, probably as counters, saying, okay, we have this much of this. And individuals were given kind of these baked clay tokens. where, say, something like a cone might represent a certain amount of emmer or wheat or what have you, barley. So an individual would have these tokens that would represent the amount of food that he could draw from the local granary. So that's how they did their record keeping, which is a little bit different, again, than the people to the north. Ubaid V is also known as the Terminal Ubaid. This lasts from about 4,300 to about 4,200, or 4,600 to 4,200. It's also known as the Late Chalcolithic in northern Mesopotamia. At this part, you begin to see more and more copper being used for a variety of purposes. Now, copper is not replacing stone tools by any stretch, but it is being added to the rotation of both tool making and jewelry. So copper is becoming more important. And this is probably something that is part of that increased industry that we talked about. Also, you begin to see potter's wheels develop further. They're using larger wheels, and they will kind of, they're axled, they're placed into the ground, a kind of pit would be dug, and there would be these notches that you could essentially kick with your foot. Now, I believe those show up at the very end of the Ubaid period, which is what this is, as you probably guessed from the Terminal Ubaid. This is kind of as the Ubaid culture begins to wind down. So this also is allowing them to produce just even more pottery that they are using for long-range trade. Also, they are beginning to use plows. They've invented very simple wooden plows that you, of course, would attach to an animal, have an animal pull that, or it could be push-powered. But these are very simple. They're kind of an outgrowth of adzes, which are kind of wooden, almost hoes. And they're used, of course, to turn up soil and things like that as you're preparing to plant. Now, the next question is, as the Ubaid culture is winding down, part of the question is, why is it winding down? It seems like they're doing a pretty good job. There's a couple of reasons for that, and we'll go into that probably next week. Well, definitely next week, actually. But there's also a probability that there are a group of people beginning to arrive in southern Mesopotamia from the outside who are probably upsetting kind of the balance of the region. Maybe not intentionally, possibly intentionally. It's hard to say. But this would be the probable arrival of the people who will eventually be known as the Sumerians. And they're probably not the only people coming in from the outside. There's probably several different outgroups that are not Ubaid or not tied into this kind of Ubaidian proto-civilization. Now, I was always under the impression when I was younger that the Ubaid people were Sumerians, but after reading a couple of books and articles in preparation for last season and this season, I've learned that that was not the case. The Sumerians were probably from outside of this region. Now, where exactly they're coming from is a matter of debate, and that stuff we'll go over in the future. But the reason that one of the first reasons that I discovered that this may be the case is that when we begin to discuss the Sumerian language, we're not going to be able to tie Sumerian in with any other tongue in terms of language family. Sumerian is considered a language isolate. No other people, at least as far as we've discovered, spoke a language related to Sumerian. But we do, of course, have the Sumerian lexicon. We do know you know, the words they created, the words that they spread. However, there are a number of words in the Sumerian language that are not apparently Sumerian. And some of those words are occupational, things like farmer, things like merchant. Now, these people are supposedly, you know, the pinnacle of civilization, at least at the very beginning of recorded history. Wouldn't they have invented those words? Well, maybe not. Maybe they adopted these words from the people who were living in the region that they moved into. This would be the Ubaidian. This theoretical language that the Ubaidian spoke is known as Proto-Euphratian. And that, of course, comes from the Euphrates River, where the early Ubaid sites have been found. And that's something that we're going to discuss next episode, along with a little bit more about migrations, genetic stuff that I didn't go over tonight or today or whenever you're listening to the episode. And also, we're going to go over that then, and we're also going to discuss kind of the period that is beginning, or the next kind of large-scale material culture that's going to arise post-Ubaid, or I guess in tandem with the Ubaid, but that will slowly supersede it. Ubaid sites are beginning to, during the terminal Ubaid period, begin to decline for a number of reasons that, again, we're going to cover next week. But the next material culture that's going to come up, and it's only going to be a very brief talk about them because they're only around 100 years or so. So essentially, their kind of formative period is coming up, and this is known as the Uruk period. And that will be kind of the precursor to what will eventually become Sumerian and Mesopotamian civilization. So please look forward to that. I hope I was clear on everything, and if you guys have any questions or comments or feedback or constructive criticism, please reach out with me. Let me know. I love hearing from viewers. I love it when also viewers send me those interesting links like that Arch Atlas document. But you can reach out to me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, or you can comment on any of the YouTube videos, which that'll have a link in the episode description to our audio podcasts. And I do stream live on YouTube most days. You're welcome to drop in chat, say hey there, ask questions there. You can't post links there because YouTube doesn't allow that. But again, come in, feel free to talk with me there. I'm live most days. It's October, so I like horror and scary stuff. So I've been doing horror games this week and pretty much the rest of this month. But the rest of the year, I usually do like history and warfare stuff, so that's probably where you'll see me playing most of the time. But that being said, thank you for joining me. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please like, subscribe, download, whatever podcast platform you're listening on, just so I can, you know, keep the show growing. It's been a good couple of, well, it's been a great, actually. This entire year has been fantastic. I think we're across all platforms. We're over 7,000 now downloads for the life of the show. But you know, it's been exponential growth. Every year, it's gotten more and more downloads. So I really appreciate that, and it does mean a lot to me. So thank you all. I will see you all next time. Have a good day and a good rest of your week. Peace.